Since this is a good-sized group, what we're going to do is have a discussion all together till 2:45. And just as, who said it this morning? I think Professor Ogletree said, we really have to get to work. So what we're supposed to deliver back to the plenary session are three ideas or three things that we could advance open access in the born digital era. So we're going to actually, at 3:15, break into four groups, have some group discussions about what those three things are that we might report back, and then we'll discuss them all as a big group. We thought what we might do is just take a few minutes for each of us here who have been asked to be facilitators to describe the open access initiatives that we're working on and how we think they're connected to, at least to our university's mission. And then I think we have enough time for everyone to really quickly introduce themselves, and then we're together as a group going to revisit this question from this morning, which is, what is the role of this collective university? Is part of the mission of the collective university open access or not? So we're really going to start with a very fundamental and basic question. So I'll just start by identifying myself. My name is Ann Margulies. I'm from MIT. I'm the executive director of MIT's Open Courseware Project. How many people know what Open Courseware is? Awesome. How many people have visited an Open Courseware site? Wow. So I can give you the really short version of what Open Courseware is. MIT announced it in 2001, so we've been working for 6 years to publish all of the educational materials used in MIT's curriculum that are created at MIT freely and openly on the web. The idea came from the MIT faculty. The reason the MIT faculty decided that this was the right thing to do is because MIT's fundamental mission is to advance education and to serve the world. So MIT felt, the faculty felt, that one of the best ways MIT can fulfill its fundamental mission is to exploit the power of the internet to share openly and freely its educational resources. We have now published 1,675 of MIT's 1,800 courses. This coming November, we will be completing it with 1,800 courses, which will represent virtually the entire curriculum at MIT. It is voluntary. MIT faculty do not have to participate unless they want to, but at this point in time, this is the statistic I'm most proud of. 85% of the MIT faculty have voluntarily contributed their course materials to OCW. And many, many, many other people, because MIT faculty use a lot of materials. They incorporate in their teaching many materials from many other people. So at this point, the number of contributors to what's now a very vast and deep resource is just under 5,000 people have contributed to the MIT OCW site. We're very happy that it's being used all over the world, every single country. We're now getting between 1.5 to 2 million visits to the site every month. Half of our visits, this is a big shocker to us, half of our visits are self-learners, unbelievably motivated, grateful self-learners who see education as their ticket to improving their lives. They're unbelievably over the top, thankful and grateful to have access to high quality educational materials they just never dreamt they would be able to have access to, things that would come out of MIT. So that's a very brief story on where we are with the MIT OCW project and why MIT is doing it. But when MIT announced it, the hope and the dream that our president and the faculty had was that if MIT did this, maybe others might do the same, and that one day MIT's OCW project would just be one of many. And today, there are actually 150 other universities who have developed open courseware projects. Now, many of them are just starting, so, and they're much smaller in scale. But we have an open courseware consortium, and we have an open courseware consortium portal at ocwconsortium.org. And this portal is now linking to those OCW sites that have launched. But they are, they represent the top universities in China, the top universities in Japan, many of the top universities across Europe. We have a new university just joined us from Iran, from Saudi Arabia, from Sub-Saharan Africa. So we're really, I think the real headline, the real story that we're so pleased with is that so many other universities who have such wonderful curriculum that's quite different than MIT's have joined the open courseware movement. So we're on the introduction part, but can you hold that question?
Yeah.
I know you. Thank you.
I'm Joel Thierstein. I'm executive director of the Connections Project at Rice. I want to ask how many people have heard of Connections. Anne's got the home field advantage. I'm not sure what it is. Connections was started by an electrical engineering professor who specialized in digital signal processing, Rich Baranek, who, upon achieving tenure, like most faculty members, decided, I will now write my opus work, I will write a book, and get it out there so all the world will know how smart I am. And he went to his advisor, who was a pretty sharp guy, and said, no, by the time you do that, digital signal processing will be passed you by, because it will take you 2 years to get your book in print. And by then, your book will be 2 years out of date. And so Rich decided that he was not going to publish a book, but come up with a better solution to publishing materials, academic materials. The result of that is Connections, which is an area where authors and scholars can come together and create content from a variety of sources and whatever. The way Rich started this project was he called all of his friends in digital signal processing, got them all together and said, you guys have created this new platform, which is an XML-based platform. It's very exciting, it's dynamic. We can do all of our interesting formulas. We can do them in MathML, so they can be semantic MathML. They can be real-time. You can create, you can plug in formulas. You can change stuff. We can have all of our diagrams and stuff be alive. And so come on, work with me on stuff. And it worked to a T. People from scholars from all over the world in digital signal processing came to Connections and started working on the site. This was in the late 90s. This is 98, 99, and early 2000. And at that point, the university said, hey, that's a good idea. That seems to be working. Why don't you try that in other fields? And it grew from there. It started off as primarily in engineering. It started off in, obviously, electrical engineering, and then expanded into the other engineering fields, math, science. And now we span pretty much all of the disciplines in academe. We're also starting to get contributors from non-academic settings and non-university level fields. We started off again primarily as a higher education platform, and now we're getting contributors in the K-12 arena as well. Our latest interesting story is from a mechanical engineer from India, who was displeased with the physics curriculum at his kid's high school in the town in India that he lives in, and said, I want to create my own. And so he's contributed a variety of modules, which is our units of entry and of data, and put in a variety of physics modules now for directed at K-12. And they're really applicable to younger, his kids are in high school, but they're really applicable to even younger kids than that, and such that they can be just kind of played with without actually, again, because of XML, you can kind of play with stuff and make it dynamic. And so we're starting to get a lot more activity in the K-12 arena. So our platform, which was originally set up as this kind of contributing kind of center for higher education, has now grown into the K-12 market as well, and we're kind of a content-neutral kind of platform. The way it aligns with Rice's university mission is that it's very, Rice is trying to reach out and become much more visible in the world. They're trying to contribute their content and their expertise to the world a lot more than they used to, and I think this is kind of aligns with MIT and a lot of universities who are now realizing we can't just keep it all in these closed walls, and it's interesting we're in an open access talk and every forum window closed. Although having sat over there yesterday, there's a big giant crane out here that swings right past that window, and so I fear for the people watching this side of the room. No offense to the gentleman in the back there. You might want to move, that crane gets too close. The idea is the universities now are starting to reach out beyond their walls. And this kind of occurred, it seemed to have been, be evolving over the last 20 years. We started off as these kind of protected ivory towers, for better or worse, or in some sense for our own protection, centuries ago. And now it's gone beyond that, and now we're into, let's get this information out to the world because we want an educated society. And this was seen by Rice's administration as this is our gift to the world. We want to make sure that this is, our information is getting out there because we're creating a lot of interesting stuff and we want the whole world to take advantage of it. And we want, and then connections is, we want the world to contribute information to each other, which is the new dynamic of the Web 2.0 and the potential of all that. Let me introduce the folks from Harvard and their Open Access Project, Elizabeth and Greg.
Hi everyone, I'm Elizabeth Stark from Harvard Law School and one of the founders of Harvard College for Culture.
I'm Greg Price from Harvard College.
And also from our group. And we've done a lot of work relating to open access in the scholarly publication sense, relevant to a workshop that we had this morning, including setting up a free thesis repository that Greg has worked very hard on to enable seniors to put their theses online and license them freely. We've also worked with Professor Schieber over here, and we're hoping to encourage faculty members at Harvard to put their articles up in really accessible repositories. Also, we wrote an op-ed about open access in the Harvard Crimson. But I think we're here today to talk a little bit more about what students, and I guess anyone on a university campus can do to promote the goals of open curricula and open courseware, and for example, how we at Harvard and those at some other universities can work with faculty, staff, administration, and other students to further these goals. One possibility might be surrounding students putting their notes or other course materials online, and also maybe issues surrounding that. Maybe professors may not necessarily want students to do that, and is that okay? Things along those lines. So we definitely, within our group, would like to promote open curricula here at Harvard and beyond. So we're looking forward to working with you in that sense.
Great. So it's always good to know who's in the room. So can we just do sort of a rapid round the room of who you are and where you're from? Mark, do you want to start?
I'm from Worcester.
That's okay.
Mike Fleming, New York.
Wendell Cardi, Belgium Foundation and Innovations Journal Public Domain.
I'm Judy Shalik. I'm in Yale. You'll know that I'm a lawyer here, but I give speeches internationally about the invention of the universe.
Mike Madison from the University of Pittsburgh Law School.
Jay Fialka from WGBH.
Alan Ryan, Director of Intellectual Property at Harvard Business School Publishing. Tracy Ann,
Tracy Robinson,
Harvard
University Library.
I'm a recent graduate of college, and I'm a researcher for the Extension School's grant to the campus design.
Maria
Monique,
Martin
Barsowski,
Foundation.
Blake Brato, I'm from Education Development Center.
Paul Goldberg, also from Education Development Center in New England. We just met.
Kat Ray, from the Appropriate Infrastructure Development Group.
Jordan Pollock, Brandeis University.
Laura Kaufman, I'm a consultant for the Electronic Publication Systems and work at the Earth Center Library.
Daniel, fellow of the Information Society,
project
at
Yale Law. My name is Jan Falk. I'm an assistant here at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Lipinski. I'm one of the librarians over at the medical school.
Stuart Cheever, professor of computer science and chair of the University of the Scholar Publishing here at Harvard.
Dave Davis. I'm a librarian at Harvard Climate Center.
I'm Linda Wells. I'm the manager of a global library, the Genzo Corporation. And I also
volunteer and you run into kids and help them with advertising now.
Regina Clifton, Newton Free Library.
Bob Delagal, Associate Professor of Dermatology at the University of Colorado.
Jeff Bernhardt, I'm editor of the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology.
Jason Lane, I'm a software engineer at Burnside.
Matthew Good, a retired citizen interested in environmental affairs and involvement of youth.
Dan Bursack, I work at Harvard School of Public Health, and also a lecturer in the Comparative Media Studies Department.
Stephen Carpenter, WGBH Media Library.
Tracy Davis, I'm a graduate student of the Media Studies Program.
Diane Williams, I'm a former T-Soul alum. I played with Peek in Open House Work, Stephen Courses.
Yes,
we have. We've had the pleasure. And I
start
IT courses at MIT,
sir. That's the reason MIT Media Lab and the Department of Urban Planning at MIT.
Jim Bunce, Cornell University.
Frank Catanzaro, Millennium Project, the Global Foresight Network, and we're compiling open courseware on futures research and futures methodologies.
Scott Quoco, I'm the founder of a software company called Leading Into Knowledge Manager.
Judy Perrell, I'm a professor of sociology at Northeastern.
Michelle Tipton, Executive Director of the Eastbase Foundation. Mary I, Director of the Archives at WGBH.
Frank Painter from Madison, Wisconsin.
Richard Irvis, Wilson.
Mike Walsh, Bar Camp Boston.
And Juan Carlos de Rafa from the University of Turing.
Mitch Jones, I'm a BU undergrad and I run our website.
Brenda Dickey, I'm an undergraduate at Brown University.
Jacqueline Hossett, a graduate of this school. I'm actually a classmate of Miles Berkman, so I've been interested in this, and I really admire what MIT and Rice are doing in the open source area. So,
John Stevenson of the IT Department of Harvard University Press.
Chris Cottley, I'm a fellow of the Berkman Center here.
Christine Madsen, I'm with the Open Lectures Program.
It's an odd route we've taken, isn't it?
I'm Randy Fenstermacher. I'm at Harvard College Library, and I'm the publisher, editor, photographer, and staff of the Guy by the Door blog, the one genuine kick-ass labor protest blog at Harvard.
Got it.
Don't know how to follow that. My name is Molly Romani. I'm with the Open Learning Exchange.
I'm Dick Rowe, Open Learning Exchange.
Josh Gannon, Brown University.
Robin, DC Clyde, graduate majoring in math, theater science.
Tony Pino, I'm a student here at the college.
Dominic Pino, I'm a retired missile systems engineer who migrated into internet development where I'm here working at New Horizons.
Any up top?
I'm Paul Reinsmith, I work at
Berkeley Center. Mark Williams, Roger Williams. Mr. Henry, big supporter of Wikipedia and OpenCourseWare, and also I have a sharp critic.
Oh, well, we'll have to hear that.
Chris Walsh, I'm a student here at law school, I work at Berkeley Center.
So I know
I'm
at Berkeley Center. Okay, is
everybody? Thank you all for that. It's amazing whenever, sometimes Joel and I are at these meetings to talk about open access or open content. And it's amazing what an eclectic collection of interests it is. You know, it's a new field. It's not like going to a meeting when it's all librarians or all faculty or all administrators. It's always incredibly exciting mixed groups like this. So our first question that we're supposed to work on together, I think, takes us back to the plenary session, and it has to do with the role of the university in this digital world. So let's just revisit that question about whether or not open access should be part of the university's mission.
Any original points of wisdom on that?
One quick question. I understood that MIT was originated as a land grant college. Is that correct or incorrect?
That's correct.
Oh, that's good.
My argument is that the tax advantage status of educational institutions makes them actually at least semi-public, if not public institutions. For example, Harvard has accumulated $29 billion. It would never have been able to do that without a special tax advantage situation. And the public pays an opportunity cost in terms of the tax base and providing services, which the payment in lieu of taxes, which universities pay, is fractions of a cent on the dollar of assessed value. So universities really are, even the so-called private universities, really are public institutions. So it's right that they do something.
An argument that universities owe it as part of their public service and partially as tax-supported institutions. Other comments? Over here?
Just to extend that idea, I think that for institutions that are strictly public, public universities, there should in fact be a legal requirement to provide open access to all people who are paying for it. They should be able to get to the information that they're paying to research and to distribute to the students who can afford it.
Okay, great.
I'm just curious, when this began at MIT, what were the nature of the objections and how were they overcome?
There were a lot. There were a lot. Most at MIT thought it was a great idea, but who's going to pay for it? But if I'm a faculty member, does that mean I'm giving away all my rights? And what if I want to publish a book? The alumni said, is this going to devalue our degree? Some students said, wait a minute, I've spent my whole career trying to get into MIT, and now you're letting everybody into MIT. But. So there are a lot of those types of concerns, mostly because it was not understood. And I think once we started publishing the materials, and people saw that really we're publishing the raw materials for an education, it really in no way is the same thing as going to MIT and being with other MIT students and being with the MIT faculty.
Did anybody feel that Foursquare would actually reduce enrollment?
I think not so much.
I wouldn't expect it to, but would that not have been the prime argument? I mean, there are some others mixed in there.
Well, I think maybe the loudest we heard were the alumni who felt that their hard-earned degrees were devalued, and maybe now it wasn't going to be so hard to get into MIT anymore. But in fact, the data that we've collected is this is now 2 years old, but 2 years ago we surveyed MIT freshmen, and 32% of the MIT freshmen said that OpenCourseWare had a positive influence on their decision to apply to MIT.
Exactly. Thank you.
So it's had exactly the opposite impact.
Two notes. One, sort of apart from a sort of financial bargain that's implicit in funding for universities, and apart from a possible legal requirement, I think of this as an ethical obligation, both on the part of the universities as institutions and on the part of the faculty as teachers and scholars. That is the nature of what they do, that their obligation ethically is to distribute and disseminate the information as broadly as possible. And second, I think it's not coincidental that the open access, open courseware movement has gotten traction at around the same time that American universities especially have begun to embrace a more global model of education generally, that is physically extending themselves around the world rather than just focusing on domestic constituencies. Mm-hmm. I think they go hand in hand.
And is that embrace like this, or is it embrace like this?
No, I think all the American universities, I think Harvard and Yale both, for example, they're very aggressive and enthusiastic about taking the show on the road, as it were, in a very tangible, physical sense. And I think that this is that the open courseware movement is complementary to really extending the university physically around the world.
So it was proactive rather than reactive.
Yep.
Let me ask this. It's sort of a variation of the same question. The Open Courseware Consortium that I mentioned, with over 150 universities, it's really growing much faster than we can hardly keep up with. But most of the growth is outside the United States. There are maybe a dozen schools in the U.S. who have developed open courseware.
Let me add to Anne's, too. I mean, we have courses in languages, Thai and Japanese and Chinese and Spanish and Portuguese, and those are the more popular courses. If you add those together, it dwarfs the English usage. So it's the same. We're experiencing the same thing.
Let's do 1, 2, and 3.
And 4.
I was thinking it was more on the previous.
That's topic. Okay.
Question, what objections get raised? And I was going to talk about one that I seen just in talking to people around here about open access and mandated open access to faculty writing, just topic near to my heart. So I'm sensitive to these counterarguments people might want to be aware of. And I should say that's not an argument I agree with, but you know, you ask what do people, how do people object? You sometimes see objection on the grounds that mandating open access is a violation, it's kind of a libertarian argument, it's a violation of faculty members' academic freedom. So, it's a little hard for me to present this argument because I don't frankly understand it. But you see it on a couple of occasions among faculty, you see it quite frequently from publishers who have other access to from. But I just bring it up. The idea being, it's my writing, you can't force me to, somehow violates my academic freedom to force me to publish it in one versus another venue.
If you publish it here, it devalues it elsewhere where you might be able to sell it.
No, it's not a financial argument. It's a libertarian argument.
It's voluntary.
And that's for mandatory.
It's voluntary.
Well,
different. So this initially from the open courseware or open access to writings that are just mandatory or voluntary.
When it's been discussed as a mandatory requirement, that's an objection that comes up. Who was number two?
That's a good question. And kind of relates to that. If professors are putting their material online, their course material, and then they want to publish a book or an article or something like that, that has some of the same material, are there objections from the publisher?
The way that open courseware works is that the faculty own the materials. They grant MIT a non-exclusive license to publish them openly. So the faculty member retains ownership. They can still do whatever they want, and they do. They still publish articles and books and whatever. They can use it commercially.
And all of our stuff is Creative Commons attribution only, so not only can the authors do it, but anybody, any other author can come along and take it from everything. So, as far as publisher objections, you have to ask the man from Wooster in the back here.
Yeah.
Some might, most probably would not.
Mm-hmm. I think Jay was next.
What I'm curious about is to what extent the online sites, as you created them, obviously, really impressed by the whole effort, but how are they perhaps not as robust or as strong as you would like them to be in an ideal world? And so what are the primary obstacles that we confront in order to make what would be an improved open courseware that doesn't have limitations in terms of user search and search?
So I'll answer for open courseware and you might comment on connections. For open courseware, the two limiting factors on how deep and rich your course will be are, number one, intellectual property restrictions. So we only publish on open courseware materials that we have permission for. So the faculty grant us permission for their work, but when they use third-party work in the classroom, which could be articles or books. Of course, we cannot publish those. So it's not as complete as certainly attending that course at MIT. The second limitation is the comfort zone of the faculty, because it's really up to the faculty member how much they want to publish. So half of our courses have exams, because half of the faculty are comfortable sharing their exams. The other half want to reuse them and aren't so comfortable. Half publish solutions. So half of the ones who publish exams publish solution sets, because they understand that that's helpful to the students to be able to practice. But you know, for obvious reasons, half don't. We had a number four. Yeah, number four.
I wonder, has OpenCourseWare had any effect on attendance at lectures, especially the 8 a.m. lectures?
Well, this, of course, was a major concern at MIT, particularly because 26 of our courses were publishing full videotaped lectures, in addition to the lecture notes and the exams and the quizzes. So why would you go to class? And the faculty were concerned with this, so we surveyed the faculty. Again, this data are 2 years old, but the faculty have not noticed a significant drop in attendance. The students who never used to come to class still don't come to class. And others, you know, for the most part, are using it as an opportunity to use their classroom time, their class time in a different way. And some faculty have told us that the students are coming better prepared for class. They're doing a little work in advance. Did you want to comment?
Yeah, I can vouch for what Dan is saying as someone who was an undergrad when at MIT when OpenCourseWare came about. I actually worked for OpenCourseWare for about 18 months, and now I'm on the faculty at MIT as a lecturer. The students do come kind of with questions in mind, and it's great to be able to get into the interesting meat of any particular topic rather than having to go over the basic building blocks. And so OpenCourseWare has had a positive impact on the teaching at MIT in that regard. It's not required, at least in my course, I don't require students to read the OpenCourseWare logs, but a lot of them do anyway. And if they come in, just when they jump in and start saying, okay, well, what do we do about this, that, and the other thing, rather than going over the material from the, you know, from the industry.
In talking about OpenCourseWare with colleagues, faculty, especially the untenured faculty, had some concerns, some of which are not true, but they worried about was if they put their work on the line, how will it be in a prestigious journal, and how will they get tenure? And there was this whole fear that somehow this will interfere with the career building traditional process.
Ooh. Yeah, the way we've addressed that problem, because that is a concern in faculty, of how does this help my tenure if I contribute stuff, especially with us? It's a little different than Anne, because we're looking for scholarly kind of things, not that you're scholarly, but journal kind of, that kind of stuff. And so faculty are concerned about that kind of thing. And what we're starting to now is to bring the vetting agencies along, the agencies that evaluate, or the, you know, agencies in the broad term, the industry associations, the discipline associations and councils who vet the material. We're bringing them onto the site and saying, okay, we're making peer review as part of the deal. And so that's the same. They would publish a journal as if they would with Elsevier, as the same as they would with us. It's just they would do it online, open, rather than publish it in hardback. Although, again, we are now perfecting our print pipeline, which is in alpha, beta, somewhere in that range of testing, where you can print out the articles you want. Or compile a journal however you want, so we'll effectively be able to give these associations everything they want.
The tenure committee is a great place.
And the tenure committee will be pleased, because it's the same vetting agency that it was before. There's no difference. And as far as the impact goes, the scholar impact, that's another thing again. And we found that to be actually more if they publish with us than in many cases, because of the way the XML databases are structured. They get hits, you know, in a variety of different sense that they wouldn't otherwise. And thus their work is cited more often and it's more available. That's not, again, across the board, but it's starting to become more so that way than it has been. So.
I have a quick question. How do you generate publicity for these initiatives? And whom do you imagine the publicity reaches? Publicity or market reach?
That's a really good question, because we don't do it very well. We actually don't, you know, we're part of a university, so we're actually, the marketing word isn't even, we don't use it. So we've been pretty passive about it, and as a result, I think our material, we're only scratching the surface and reaching the people who could benefit from our material. Fortunately, we have gotten a lot of media coverage, and every time that we do get media coverage in a major newspaper, we see a huge spike in our traffic, and then it comes down about half. But about half of those people have discovered something that's really, really useful to them. So it's something we should be much more strategic about, but we're not.
If I could follow up on that, as far as, you know, three things that really affects open university access and that sort of thing, it seems as though these sorts of programs are an ideal platform for continuing education for secondary and primary school teachers. Insofar as new topics are always coming out, and secondary curricula are much slower to change than university curricula, which is, or that's my perception, it seems as though this is something that the Department of Education and the National Science Foundation might be interested in, as far as, you know, making sure that secondary teachers stay up to date.
So building awareness among secondary education.
The National Academy of Sciences.
And also, you know, generating capital.
Yeah.
I like your thinking, because that's our first category of vetting is the people who deal with the NCPEA, which is the association that does principals and administrators. And so we're going down that path already. So, yep.
Richard has been.
Can you just comment on the perceived impact on the quality of the instruction that both institutions as a result of OCW?
Sure. How has OpenCourseWare impacted the quality of instruction at MIT? So this is another one of those big surprises that we had. About 2 years ago, we started noticing, when we were looking at our traffic, that there was a huge amount of traffic from our site, from the MIT network to our site. And we conducted a number of surveys. And yes, indeed, MIT students, 2-year-old data, we're doing surveys now, but over 70% of the MIT students used the site regularly, so the MIT students were using it heavily. 40% of the MIT faculty reported using the OpenCourseWare site to prepare for their classes, to see what their colleagues are teaching, to actually look at the prerequisites to their course to see if the students were actually learning what they thought they were learning. And then, so that was the sort of obvious stuff that we had clear data for. But some of the more subtle things that my staff report are when they would sit down to, before we publish a course, our course goes into the staging area and a faculty member has to sign off on it. And when the faculty would go and look at the course before they would approve it for publishing, they'd go, you know, I should really add this, and I've always thought about changing that, and I know the students always struggle here. And then they start looking at how some of their colleagues are teaching, and they say, and I noticed that Professor Schmedlap has an image gallery, and that would actually really work pretty well with what I'm trying to do. So there's been, at MIT, all these walls that have been existing between all of the academic departments are coming down, because now the MIT faculty are much more aware and understand much more about what each other is teaching. And I'm sure they're learning a lot of best practices from each other in a very informal way. Okay. And they're actually collaborating in new ways. You know, a faculty member from Ocean Engineering had a knock on his door, he told me, and there's a faculty member for 20 years had been down the hall and around the corner in mechanical engineering, and he said, I was just looking at lecture 8 of the course you're teaching, and I didn't know you were teaching vibration theory. I teach vibration theory. The two of them now are working on a new course at MIT, combining their expertise. So, I mean, the news here, the benefits to MIT have been enormous, even though this is not what motivated MIT to do OpenCourseWare?
Yeah, we're experiencing the same thing. The cross-disciplinary junctures that are now being made is amazing, and we can build the same kind of stories, word for word. The other thing, just back to your marketing question, marketing in this area sucks. It's real simple. It does. Our group was founded by, no offense to those in the room, computer scientists and technologists who don't have the first clue about marketing. I'm the first person that they got who has any, and academicians. Academics don't know about marketing. We're not good at that. It's not something we do, and we need to get better at it. If this is going to work, we need to get better at it. So you're right.
He had his hand up.
Two quick questions. First, before OpenCourseWare at MIT, was there any intern system for professors to post lecture notes and slides to MIT students?
There were many. That's part of the problem.
So what you're saying, you're mentioning that students are better prepared now. Is that because professors are doing more stuff online?
It's dramatically accelerated the use of the web at MIT. 5 years ago, only about half of the courses at MIT had any form of a website. Many of them were thin.
And my other point was, in effort to advance OpenCourseWare, awareness of PR is great when you have OpenCourseWare set up at a school like MIT. And I think that what we have to do is get other schools like Harvard to do that. And part of that might lie in educating the faculty at potential universities about dispelling some of the myths of open course.
I wonder if we could hear from the critic.
Well, let's I'm going to Elizabeth and Greg to respond to that, because they're here at a lower level trying to push grassroots the other direction. Did you hear his question? Can you?
Right. Well, yeah. I was thinking, first I wanted to chime in about marketing, in the sense that, tell people about OpenCourseWare, tell people about the really positive experiences that schools that have already implemented OpenCourseWare have had. And I think that's a place where students can really help out, because I'm assuming many of the students here are familiar with, say, email lists, blogging, even communicating with the press. But there are many means of marketing and advancing OpenCourseWare and getting the word out that may not necessarily involve, here's an ad or something, what we typically think of as marketing. So I think in that sense, we can make use of, say, the network of all the people that we have here, assuming we're all for OpenCourseWare. That's another thing I want to get to. But then when it comes to educating faculty, I think that students that support OpenCourseWare are in a prime position to do so. Because I think unless there's a faculty member that's extremely passionate about a particular issue, and here at Harvard, or who is, maybe they won't necessarily have a resource or someone who knows a lot about the benefits, knows a lot about what OpenCourseWare is. And if we could get students on campuses to educate faculty members and the administration, I think that could really go with the goal.
Well, along these marketing lines, say something a little bit in defense of Harvard here. MIT has done a very good job about being systematic about making this stuff available, but it isn't the case that Harvard, on the other hand, has closed all access to everything. A lot of the lessons of OpenCourseWare get exhibited in course websites at Harvard all the time, and have for a long time, even for OpenCourseWare. I had a website where I used to teach a course in programming languages, where I put up extensive notes on the website. This was when I first started teaching here many, many years ago. And I used these notes and updated them over time. And a couple years later, I got a note from somebody in South America, some professor in South America, thanking me for providing these notes on programming languages, which she had used in her own course on programming languages for the last several years. And I was surprised. Not to squeeze, what the heck, there's no reason not to use it, but this is kind of inadvertent OpenCourseWare on my part. The difference now is that people are aware that when they put things up on their websites, but there are a large number of courses at Harvard, essentially every course part of the website, it may not be very...
At every university.
Well, at every university. And they're often made public at the discretion of the professor at MIT, And
Do you think courses in other fields are made public? Because I know you have to have a minimum audience.
It's all in the discretion of the...
Right. Because my impression is that many, say, in technology field, at the law school, I was a teaching fellow for two classes where we had a public wiki and had a public website and some pieces for the syllabus and all the sources online and the video from the class. But in, say, maybe humanities or other fields along those lines...
Could be. So what's missing is the marketing aspect, that is the agreement among the faculty that in general, right, the default would be everybody, these websites are kind of open. The other thing I was mentioning is there's also a program to facilitate faculty improving their websites and adding innovative content and so forth, the so-called instructional computing group, for instance, program.
I just wanted to chime in quickly. Just one problem with, in that case, is I know, say, for example, there are courses at the college where they do have websites, but I'm not so sure that they're necessarily aggregated in a way that would make it easy to just scroll down, see a list of courses that are publicly available, and then click on this one to find it. Okay, so that might be something we can work on.
I was just wondering if materials in the courses are all from the professor of the course, or is there any content from, you know, somebody outside of the course, forming partnerships with other kind of organizations to add appropriate content and give courses, and that would obviously be another way of increasing awareness of other sort of users and interactions with other educational institutions and so forth.
Yeah, our content's open, our site's open to everybody. Anybody can contribute. And my 8-year-old has an account and she's contributing. Now I don't know what vetting agency has vetted her work to be scholarly yet, but she's a genius and all, she's my kid, but we'll see how it goes. We address that by everything is open and anybody can contribute. Then the endorsing part of our site, where that's the quality control, where an endorsing agency, say Harvard, MIT arrives, it doesn't matter, comes along and says, we endorse this content. And then the endorsement stays with that. Even though the content may be changed, morphed into something else, the endorsement stays with the original content until the endorsing agency says, I now recognize this scholarship as being superior or equal to this one. I'm going to recognize both or whatever. And so then it's endorsed and flows along. So that way we maintain the quality control and yet allowing the openness and allowing everybody to be a part of the site.
Informing partnership with like your local public television station if they have the right to content to add it to a course on history or, you know, so forth and so on, doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, we've are the WGBH people here somewhere? Yes. Yeah, we've talked to you about stuff. So yeah. Oh, all right. There. Sorry. Yeah. We've talked to you guys about stuff. So yes.
But not me.
Not you, no. Sorry. And it wasn't me that talked, it was somebody else, one of my people, so sorry.
I had two comments. The first is another way that it's sort of marketed is an organic way where one person is just really as basic as one person telling someone else who knows someone else is interested, who saw some course that they thought that they could get value from. And that's another way that it sort of expands exponentially. The other point I'd like to bring up is that we know that the faculty is very busy and they have a full plate, and that might make some of them reluctant to contribute. So I know at Tufts what we do is try and make it as painless as possible for them and, you know, sort of take the onus off of them and, do the majority of the work on our own and have sort of a process where they don't have to spend a tremendous amount of time contributing their course, which might make them reluctant otherwise to participate in the project.
I'm glad my comments sparked so much attention. I did use the word marketing, but I also started with just the general word publicity, which sort of captures a lot of the things that people have been saying. I'm from a project that is looking at what Harvard is doing online right now. And the closest thing that Harvard has, as much as mentioned on the courseware, is that 25 courses taught through Harvard College are offered online simultaneously. It's restricted. Anyone can see the first two lectures, which is long enough for them to decide whether or not they'd like to take the course. at which point they have to enroll, and everything is sort of password protected. The thing, I agree with making the process as easy and painless for professors as possible, but I think that there are certain things that have to be done. At this point, I've interviewed probably 60% of the professors who are involved in these 25 courses. And overwhelmingly, they don't really want anything to do with the website, and that their TFs manage the way the website looks, the material they put up there, and interactions with their distant students. And I think that it's possible to make it too easy. I was very excited when I heard about your idea of the staging area, and the fact that you have to review the online version of their course and sign off on it before it goes public. Because I think that one thing that I think if you're publishing your lecture notes and you have a website that you've been paying for a long time, that's different. But I think most Harvard professors don't view their course websites as a publication, as a really tangible version of their work. And if it were introduced to them in that way, they would be much more serious about the way the websites look and the material and the way the material is presented on the website. Because all of our faculty are accomplished, published, professional. But I don't think that the university really looks at course websites in that same way that MIT professors seem to be encouraged to have the open course websites. The issue is the legitimacy of a website as a scholarly sort of presentation of information. And once you get past the idea that the website is really sort of a dumping ground for the course material that the students can sort through themselves, then you reach a new level of sophistication in terms of the approach that faculty do.
If I could just comment on this, the MIT culture was exactly the same 5 years ago. Exactly the same, maybe even worse. What's really happened at MIT over the last 5 to 6 years is a complete change in mindset. What we've really done is we've built a new culture, and the culture is about sharing. And what's happened most recently, and this is just anecdotal, but I can certainly start to see it, when faculty, now around commencement and all the prizes come up, I'm being contacted to write letters of support for faculty who are being nominated for very prestigious prizes. So the other nominating faculty are asking me to write a letter about the impact that this faculty's website has had around the world. Another, at a faculty committee that I'm a member of, what was mentioned the other day, and it warmed my heart, was that for the first time this spring, some of the tenure packets that were reviewed, the tenure binders, now have references to the faculty members' OpenCourseWare sites, the quality of their site, the quality of their teaching, and the impact of their site outside of MIT. This is a revolutionary change in mindset.
And why did that happen?
What are the lessons learned about how that mindset happened? How did that happen?
How did that happen? it's because it's how everything happens. There are early adopters, and then they saw that the early adopters got all kinds of positive feedback from people all over the world who were benefiting and praising them and thanking them, and they got to see that they were contributing not only to their field but contributing to people all over the world, and the word spread. And then the tipping point happened when all of a sudden people weren't saying, "Are you publishing an OpenCourseWare?" But the students were saying, "Why aren't you publishing an OpenCourseWare?"
It just. And the word publishing is
used specifically.
We use the word publishing. We talk about it as a publication, it's not distance education. We're sharing materials openly, we're sharing the raw materials, we're inviting feedback, I'm not going to call on people
anymore.
Right,
go ahead.
Call on people.
Right up there.
Okay. Yeah, let's go this way.
I don't want to take attention off of the university, but I wanted to re-raise an issue that came up a little earlier and ask whether there are anything that you would consider credible, similar kinds of experiments below the university level. So there's secondary or even elementary. It seems to me the issues are quite different at the secondary level and very different at the elementary level. But I know that there are some attempts to do stuff. They don't strike me as credible. So the question is there something I don't know about?
No, you know, we did extensive research on this this last year because MIT's president is very concerned about what's happening with science and math education, and we're trying to figure out, could the open courseware model have an impact? What we learned, since we're not secondary educators, but we did a big survey of websites out there to support science and math education for, well, we started with high school, and then people kept saying, well, that's way too late, so you have to look earlier. What we found are, you know, many gems and treasures, but bits and pieces, fragmented, and not very many used. There's been a huge amount of money invested in educational websites in K-12, very, very few successes. So why is that? I don't have all the answers, but what we think are some of the answers are, first of all, state standards are all different. Teachers have to teach to those standards. If they can't immediately find something that they can plug in exactly to meet that standard, they're not going to use it. The materials are so fragmented, it's hard to find what you want to find as a teacher, and so on and so on. But those were the two, when we did focus groups with educators, that's what they told us. It's just too fragmented, and it doesn't plug into what they have to teach.
Yeah. Just a quick comment on the state standards. Remember that they are the teeth in those state standards supplied by the No Child Left Behind Act, which is brought to you by the same person that wants to give you vouchers to get out of systems to which that law applies and into systems to which that law doesn't apply. It's not very good to apply to schools.
Yeah, that's a little bipartisan, but a little. Anyway, but, so yes, it's yeah. both parties do that. It doesn't matter. It happens to be Bush at the moment. Yeah.
I just want to put a quick comment.
He's from Texas.
One of the keys to the replication of what you guys are doing with your advice at MIT open courseware initiatives are to let the faculty members know really early on what the value add is for them, and to really make it like you guys could also, in terms of the work that you're putting out, have really clear who to engage and participate in these programs that might skew the uptake to the school.
So what's in it for the faculty? And say it early and often.
Yeah, like, you know, I'm familiar with the actual courseware site at MIT, but I'm wondering, is there information like what you've been presenting here, this evolutionary history, the objection, what was overcome, MIT is better off now than it was before, is that... It's not exactly marketing, but it's definitely part of the sell. Certainly institutions that are considering implementing this would go to the site. If what you just told us in here is not on there, I'd say it beckons being put on. That's because this is very interesting. I think people would ideally like to know what was overcome and what were the benefits that were completely unforeseen. So I don't know if that's a point that's relevant to this meeting or not, but is that something that we go back and maybe push for, just because very low leverage, but I think a lot of return.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I'd like to think of the future a bit more. You said that there are only 12 American universities that are developing an open coursework program. I think that's a big problem. And I don't know very much about the open coursework consortium, but would MIT consider opening up the platform itself, not just the coursework, but giving the software behind it? I don't know how, if it's, I don't know the inner workings, but the signing off system, the method of approving material and that sort of thing, would they consider opening the source for that so that other universities could implement their own open coursework system? But not even universities, even things like Wikiversities.
We have a partnership with Wikiversity, actually, so but that's a different issue because they're not doing well. But our platform is open. The software is open. You can take it. Any university can take it. Everything we do is open. So you can you can take the software and whatever, so.
And we haven't actually developed it at MIT, but there's an open source, open courseware platform that many of the universities who are developing open courseware are using, and they've built into that many the workflow that we use and others use. And what the consortium is working together on is continuing to develop that open source platform, as well as best practices to make it very easy to develop open courseware. It's called Edu Commons. It's developed by Utah State University.
Mm-hmm. Right, and both of us are part of that. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk about how this type of stuff relates to work professors do that's included in courseware systems, some of which like may be proprietary, like for example at Peru, they use Blackboard. And there is a theory, they might not object, but the question is, if a school is using something like that, how do they get it, you know, off Blackboard or whatever, into whatever? And then the second related question is, do you know of business schools that are part of the consortium? What's Harvard Business School's response? Or MIT actually has some Sloan schools. What's their response been to the open issues?
So I'll take both, I guess, quickly. Many of the other universities who are doing open courseware have Blackboard or WebCT systems, and there has been an interface that's been built which allows you to export from your learning management system. So think of the learning management system that's used for teaching is very dynamic. It has course administration features, homework tracking, grading. Those systems have all the content in digital forms, so there is now software that is used by many consortium members to export the content from that into the Edu Commons or another platform. So typically the teaching site is very dynamic. The open courseware site is a snapshot of the raw materials after the course has been taught with all of the copyrighted materials that we don't have permission taken out. That's kind of the difference between the two sites, but they're separate sites.
And there's a variety of the open course management sites, Sakai, and there's others there. I mean, they're great with most of them.
Sloan schools, are they in?
They're in. Check them out.
Yeah.
Sloan, they're some of our best courses.
Yeah.
To answer this question, also, yesterday I was at an event to talk about Dartmouth's executive education. And I mentioned about, you know, being a Sloan alum, about going to some of the courses, and they really appreciated hearing the feedback, because not all of them knew about that, and even previous alum from Tuck. Also, I'm also come back to meet some of the new students that have been admitted and making a decision whether or not they want to go to University of Chicago, MIT, and I said, well, in addition to being Boston, Cambridge, you can take a look at some of the courses in advance and see what you'd like to have. And they seem to really appreciate that. You know, if they don't know it already, then they really appreciate it. But I was curious, my question is about your web analytics. I know you were saying you know how many people abroad are doing it versus internally, but do you ask like two or three questions, ask people what the demographics are? Like yesterday, I met a lot of people who are in mid-career, thinking about doing a change and brushing up on their skills, or you might have people in different, you know, like you say. I also volunteered for the Cambridge Science Festival, and John Durant, the director of the MIT Museum, and I were talking about that, about promoting for next year the whole interest in science for pre-K to 12 before they come to MIT. And, you know, sort of like if this is another selling tool too, also in terms of getting people involved in it. So I was curious about how you determine what your demographics are, or if you do have a breakdown, or you just know by the IP.
We have a lot of data about our users because we conduct a survey annually.
Okay.
And so we do analyze that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I historical trajectory, I guess I'm almost the same age as Stuart. And I put all my courses out, you know, for years, and I got more elaborate, you know, I never used a wiki, but I had bulletin boards and I had discussion sections, and then the university put in WebCT, okay, and started to migrate to that. But then Facebook came along, and all the student participation and all these other tools essentially just fell to zero because they go on Facebook 13 to 15 times a day and check their wall. And so I've gone back to my website, this thing, a static piece of HTML that has a class schedule on it, and you know, and occasionally links to the assignments that they can reprint. And it's just like this option where the student connection to these web properties associated with courses went up, got distracted, went somewhere else, and now they're gone. I actually don't see much advantage now, okay, in doing all the work to set up, put up all the class notes and convert all the lectures to PDFs and everything else, because they stopped really looking at them except for the day before the test.
They have a Facebook site?
I do, but Facebook doesn't have appropriate filters, and so there's like too much information on there for me, and I don't really like to use it. But
you can post it on your own.
I think they
did. I back of it, did
go with the website.
Howard University seems to have open houses for different departments, you know, to students and such who want to learn a major in sophomore or junior year. And of course, the same issue will be addressed by people who are entering schools being undergraduate graduates from the house. And I think these kind of things should be brought to the index so that people can make a decision about which departments they usually want to choose by snapshots of classes, commentaries from students and faculty members. I think that would help the admissions process across the board for undergraduates and graduates. That's the simple suggestion. The second suggestion is to have statistics support for another morning session over here on the Wikipedia exam code, where what do we at universities do? We do two things. We organize data, and then we reorganize data by being creative for how we reorganize data, versus Wikipedia people who just basically summarize the data pretty accurately. So perhaps for universities to be a much greater force than Wikipedia, or a nonprofit organization, or actually a foundation for Wikipedia is actually by cooking the amount of funding it has, perhaps the association of universities versus the association of research libraries could come up to sort of Wikipedia and cover a larger ground and be a sort of clip note or monocote to students from the nation and perhaps download it for 99 cents, you know. For iBooks, you know, certain important things. For people who have the money, for people who don't, give them free access to such global countries for some laptop, one laptop project. And of course, you know, then if you want to go a little bit further, you know, from the foundation, we might make sure you're revenue and spend it in a non-profit way. We sort of have our Fish Intelligence Program, which links kind of hits at this university of Wikipedia type broader agenda than the Wikipedia organization right now. They say, yes, we're see what kind of information you're looking at, and we have database over related advertisements that you might be interested in based on the kind of knowledge base that you're searching for Wikipedia of universities, and you know, use this revenue for research for the effects.
That is a grand vision. Connected all the dots. Can I just so we get our job done that we're supposed to get done, who is there anyone who would like to argue or you know truly believes that open access to educational materials or providing access, open access to educational materials should not be the role of a university?
Or even more specifically, if anyone would like to argue against open courseware and why implementing that plan.
Should we not
I just want to argue against it at the lower grade because I think that adults who want to say learn technological skill or business skill to be self-motivated, go find it, look at it, use it. But if you put a smorgasbord in front of children, they'll just go to YouTube or something.
Okay.
And play. You know, so I just don't think open courseware works for the junior set. They need to have stuff that's more structured and motivating.
K through what are you?
K through 8, I think.
K through 8?
Dying there, okay.
But can I respond to that?
Yeah.
So the intent, I mean, the original intent for motivating freedom came from courseware, and certainly the intent for other efforts in K-12 was not that you make materials that you expect second graders to go online and learn after themselves. You make materials for second grade teachers. They're adults. They're capable of processing this information, but they have a tremendous amount of work to do. And it's really a great help to them if they don't have to recreate the lesson plans every second grade teacher in every separate classroom. And if you can build those and make that available, especially if you can do
it
in
patterns, that's a great project. And the various sorts of math repositories and stuff all over the lab, and a lot of those were not ultimately sustainable. Some were.
Well, I think we should ask.
There's someone in the back. Okay, sorry.
One comment and one question. The comment is on this shift in technology, Second Life, et cetera, sort. I think anything in this direction has got to assume that technology will continue to change and hopefully improve. And therefore, it's incumbent upon anybody moving in this to have a substantial R&D effort somehow, so that you don't get way behind and you don't get passed by the fact that technology is in place. But what you have won't work with it. So that's the observation. So far, we've avoided what I think is a big issue, and that is, though everyone kind of likes the idea of open access, the issue of degrees and certificates. In other words, none of this so far leads to a degree. You have to enroll, you have to pay the tuition, and you have to go through the hoops, and then you get a degree. There are, as you know, a lot of open access degree granting, open university type things, and that's controversy, which I think we haven't talked about, but which somehow needs to be dealt with at some point in this discussion, because it's great for me to be able to learn a little more about algebra or quantum physics, but for my career, and for my development and getting the job, that degree, or that certificate, or that something that shows I've done something that some institution has said is okay, remains a very important part of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. What I had to say was similar, so, in the sense that the fact that people were teaching may go to the site, or people who are wanting to learn. I'm looking for a point of clarification about using open coursework. So the material is up there, but if I have a question about the material, do I have direct access to the faculty or to students who are also having questions about that material?
No.
And if not, maybe there's a missing part to that material really being useful in a broader sense.
Yeah, I would love to comment on this. That's very insightful, because we did a couple of years ago add discussion groups, we call it, to our courses, to allow students to help students or teachers to help students, and we intended for them to be self-managed discussion groups, because we at MIT cannot possibly respond to or provide access to our faculty, or that would have killed it. So we actually try to protect and create a buffer to the faculty so they don't get inundated with questions and with email. These discussion groups were a complete failure. It's why I was intrigued by your comment. It was around the same time that social networking sites took off. And so, we don't know exactly why they didn't work. Partly, I think we had a kludgy, a not very good interface. It was right around when social networking sites were. We have a very international audience, and it was at the course level, so it was a very granular level. So there are a number of reasons why we tried to provide an opportunity for people who were struggling with something to get help from other people, but it honestly was a failure. We're now exploring what now seems to be popping out there are educational networking sites. So instead of the Facebooks and MySpace, where it's social, we're exploring similar technologies to enable self-managed communities using social networking type of software to create communities around a subject area. We're hoping to be able to do that sometime this year. This is being done through the Open Courseware Consortium. So it's not just at the MIT level, it's at the consortium level.
My students and I experimented with some basically move-based educational chaplains, and they did exactly what yours did. They were really popular, and then about the time of Facebook and social networking, they died. And I think it was the students are going to spend so much time online interacting, and it's not going to be
Educational classroom.
It's not doing the educational thing, and I said, hey,
yeah, we lose that every time.
Just what you said, do the professors, when they get contacted by a stranger from around the world for something at WebCT, do they have a mechanism to report to you? Or do they just say, ignore it, or respond as they like?
Some faculty, well, the feedback comes to us, and then we'll pass it on to the faculty, we'll sort of sort it out, and if we'll pass it on, but it's not hard to figure out how to get a faculty member's email address. Yeah, so many of the faculty get email, not a single faculty has complained about it, some ignore it, some love it, and some answer every one of them.
Or something that could be like a Linux service model where you give away the courseware for free, and then you build a service bureau to help people who are stuck.
Yeah. two big questions. First, you talked about when the coursework came in, the professors could see for the first time what each other were teaching, and they sort of killed the redundancies among the courses. And then you also have this consortium. Is there any thought that as the consortium grows, the offerings within it will begin to diversify so that you won't have sort of all 12 of these universities offering the same basic physics class, for instance, or similar versions of the same material? Do you think that these redundancies will start to cancel out on a larger level than within a particular institution? And then second, I was just curious if at either one of your institutions, there's a consensus that a certain type of class can't be translated into this medium. You know, you can't do a seminar online, or you can't do a lab course online, or I don't know. You know, advanced chemistry doesn't work when you're trying to make a website out of it.
Actually, it does, but that's a different question. Let's move on.
While we've been talking, I was searching for a resource at my university, which I didn't even know existed in the very room you mentioned to me last time at the reception, which is something called a super course.
Pittsburgh. Are you
at School of Public Health, where one of our faculty has created a web archive of public health lectures from thousands of faculty around the world. It sort of fits generally in this space, but it raises a question, which is, I think most of the conversation we've had focuses on MIT's program and the default that these are programs centered on particular existing university institutions, whereas the Connections Project, for example, or the super course idea really is either disciplinary in the super course example or the multi-institutional or cross-institutional. I guess it's an observation more than a question, but if there's an implicit question, which is why do we assume that this has to be based at the given university rather than, I think building up your comment, sort of expanding our ideas of what the default institution is to begin with. This might be disciplinary, interdisciplinary, and so forth, but in ways that sort of break up our existing ideas of what the conventional university is.
Can I just comment on this? Can we get back to your question and even the discussion of branding in the plenary session? The question of quantity versus quality is debated at every single consortium meeting. Do we want every course that's taught to be in an open courseware, or do we really just want high quality, you know, the best of the best, in a repository that's open courseware? So the consortium debates this every single time. One of the reasons why we took an institutional approach was to have the brand of the university be the control mechanism for quality. So when you go to look at an open courseware site, you decide as a consumer which you want to go to, you know, based on the quality that that brand represents. Now, having said that, our four latest members of the consortium, we're already breaking that model, are from multiple institutions based on an interdisciplinary focus. So we have a group of four universities developing an open courseware together on bioinformatics, because they've said it's such a cutting edge field, we all shouldn't be inventing the same course all the time. So they're working together to develop a joint bioinformatics course in a consolidated open courseware. And there are now four examples of that, and this has just happened.
And we're working with Anne and her group to help them see the light that this can be interinstitutional as well. Now, actually, we have talked to their consortium about doing it.
Yeah.
Is the UNESCO Virtual University a part of the consortium, the international consortium? Or have you worked with them?
We have.
Okay.
Yeah, we've worked with them, and they're, in fact, they're sending different vessels. Well, you would be working here, and you know this is a broad organization. Yeah. Many fingers. We're working with one of the fingers. So actually, with several of the fingers, there's probably 10 or 20. Yeah. Yes. Yes and no. But we need to get our questions answered here. We're getting prompted by Elizabeth, I think.
I wonder if we should boil it down to three. We're supposed to have
in if we don't.
Three.
Don't do what you're supposed to. You won't be in trouble. Do what you're not in trouble.
Don't help me. I'm in enough trouble always.
I always follow instructions.
Yeah, she's in charge.
No, I'm not in charge, but I always follow it.
Okay, never mind.
Oh, you set yourself up for that.
What are the standards for what standards have to do that? What are we trying to do?
What we were told as facilitators is we're supposed to have three ideas out of this work group on how to advance open access for the university that met the collective, not. The idea of certificates comes up all the time. Just MIT has decided that it's a very complicated question to get the whole faculty around. I think it's going to continue to come up and continue to be debated. I can't predict where we might come down on that.
Well, you could start a new university.
Yeah.
I was saying before, like call it Red Hat University, which takes a free resource and sells, you know, testing and certificates that prove that you've gone through courseware that MIT is so kindly provided for free. And then Red Hat University could provide certificates and sheepskin around the content. It's not stolen, right? Because it's
These have popped up. They're more like tutoring centers, and they do grant certificates. And we have said okay to them as long as they don't have MIT on the certificate.
Well, but those certificate granting institutions exist in other parts of the world. They don't here.
Yeah.
But
right. So here in Cambridge, it might be hard. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Even outside Cambridge in the U.S.
Just in terms of a specific recommendation. Is there something like the Journal of Open Access? And if not, shouldn't there be a way whereby the body of knowledge around this can be published in a systematic way? Wouldn't the Berkman Center be a logical place for such a journal to be, an online journal, to be created? I'm talking about following up on your suggestion about the knowledge that we are creating.
The discussion we've just had.
Yes. And those that we haven't had.
Well, yeah. The papers on us, where are they published?
I think Dick is referring to sort of open access as a field.
That's correct. He is too. Right. Same.
And you're a field where.
Your opening comment that somehow or other this is something different.
Yeah, it is.
And so one of the functions of a university is to, in fact, take a body, an emerging body of knowledge, and make sense of it, and have a place whereby that knowledge can be observed and added to and so forth. Seems like a logical recommendation that we would make.
I like that.
Right.
Go ahead.
Just to give you a head start on maybe boiling down to three, because as I look at that list, maybe we're not that far away. Perhaps
awareness, PR, secondary education can be combined with educating faculty. It's an education process to people. Perhaps the aggregation issues can be combined with possibilities for collaboration. And perhaps there's a connection between the obstacles and determining what the process is, so that you can take your six and boil them down to three using, you know, I'm not sure if that works, but I saw you were concerned, Annie, so I'm
a very goal-oriented person.
Okay. I think that kind of works, so we can add the idea.
Yeah.
So I'd like to add, this is my main criticism. So if you're looking at open access from a global perspective, and you want some courseware, more likely to nugget information about something, you want something that's best in class or active. Everything else is junk. So quality improvement should be sort of inherent in many of those line items up there, but that should be sort of one of the key things. Probably the key thing is that you have a process which improves quality as quickly as possible. And so one of the things I learned at Sloan is that you need continuous process and quality improvement. Open courseware process right now is quite far from that. And that the lecturers still create their notes before classes, they test them with their class, then it gets embedded into the process that scrubs out all of the proprietary content that's being used from other sources, and then it gets published to the web. So the process right now is quite long. It's difficult for students to go through the material and say, oh, I read this section four or five times and I still don't really understand it, but maybe what he's trying to say is this, and then to rewrite portions of the course. So another idea that ties into this is the problem you have about reputation and the quality of your degree, and faculty being overloaded by people from all around the world coming with queries potentially. I wonder actually how much faculty get hit because they're named on the courses. There are 1,050 in their course to get email out of that. But to actually change the notion of education that might be very radical, which is to make use of the fact that you don't really know something until you've taught it. And to use the faculty kind of at the top, and then the teachers, the students below that, the TAs, and then the students below that are actually in the class, as teachers are people who are out there using open courseware.
I'd like to follow up. That came up in a meeting 2 days ago, where we were talking about how best to sort of offer a seminar in an online situation to, you know, many, many different people. And it seemed like the best way to do it would be to have a seminar with, you know, graduate students and professors discussing issues, and then it would be the responsibility of the graduate students to discuss the same issues with a group of students, you know, taking the course by a distance, and that there's a sort of trickle-down effect.
Right.
You know, so that lets you reach a much larger number of people without putting a huge strain on the professor and without putting a huge strain on the resources in the university to hire people to talk to people on the side of the
right.
So that becomes a part of the grade. So.
Yeah, I would just say that sort of a key part of this is actually the software that makes the processes possible. So when we're talking about open courseware, I mean, discussions were used, critical discussions were used for a while and failed absolutely. And there are many reasons for that, and also that blogs are not a very good way of transmitting information to later generations of students or to other students around the world. But the software actually really continuously improved, basically put a diode on Wikipedia, wiki software, and continuously upgrade the quality. That software doesn't really exist yet. And it means being able to focus on just the right granularity, structuring interactions, being able to have ownership, being able to control the way the information gets out. All these issues need to be resolved. And when they'll eventually get resolved by software, and when that happens, then open courseware and many other things will begin to use that software as part of our process. It will replace blog, it will replace Wikipedia, it will replace quick discussions and to launch your email.
I
I was thinking about going all the way back to the IP licensing and content issues. Free is great, but I don't think everything's ever gonna all be free. And what about if there was a platform that was voluntary, people could put in their content, and get paid some, probably like an iTunes or something that doesn't exist yet. Everything there is the same price, but you do get it.
Do you know there is an iTunes University?
For podcasts.
For podcasts, Stanford, Berkeley. We've taken some of our open courseware sites and put them on MIT and iTunes University, just as another distribution channel. Because again, our goal is for as many people as possible to benefit, to create as much access as possible.
The one thing I would say, sort of in response to this idea of, you know, a quality improving diode, is that one of the issues with teaching is that there is no single best way to explain anything, I don't think. So part of saying, well, this wasn't clear to you, but, you know, what if you say it this way, you would need to make sure that one of the strengths of it would be multiple explanations available to students. So, well, this didn't work for you, why don't you try this, instead of just sort of trying to narrow it down to one
method. Well, that's absolutely right. And there's multiple languages, and there are multiple backgrounds of first in calculus, some statistics. So you have to address that.
When you talk about how people learn with these open courses, is there a need for textbooks? Or can someone learn completely without needing to buy a textbook or other reading material that isn't included because it is copyrighted? Is that an issue that you're looking at or are aware of or dealing with?
Because are we looking at a complete courseware that you're publishing up there, or simply aggregating content produced by the faculty to help them with their own courses, so it is channeled and made available to others without it being taxed time-wise or additionally?
It's actually yes to all of those. Uh-huh. Some of the courses have just lecture notes and are an extensive reading list, and really for you to be able to use it as a self-learner,
right,
you need to go and buy a book. But educators just find the syllabus useful. It really depends if you're an educator or a self-learner or a student, sure, how you use the materials. 40 of our courses have full online textbooks because the faculty decided to just publish their textbooks online instead of going the traditional route.
I was wondering, do you think that there's a business out there for some company that where you have your material there, and then there's some article which is copyrighted, so you can't put it up, but you'd have a link that would say, if you're interested in something to the effect, if you're interested in this article, click here, and it would automatically take you somewhere, or some company site or whatever, where you could then deal with the copyright stuff, whatever, and then get it.
Right, but who decides the link?
Well, no, the one putting the promotion over there, or the author?
Well, the author obviously gets paid, but
well, then,
I guess.
But it's like doctors getting paid for drug companies.
No, I want my students, as a professor, I want my students to read some articles.
Oh, sorry.
So I put a link to it. And most publishers' websites already support that, so if you just link to the right page.
Right.
We do that for the publishers who will grant us permission to publish some of their copyrighted materials. We'll provide a direct link to the publisher's site from our reading list, and we can make it much easier for people to find the books.
We have time for three more. One here, two, three.
As a publishing model, we've been experimenting within the industry of bundling textbooks to make short extracts or chapters available for purchase, which would seem to fit very well with the dealing that's as well. That's really commercially viable for it.
Yeah. Rising for the C cells over there. He was described in the New York Times a couple days ago about the Penn Style's paper of the Life Scribe. And perhaps we should move to the MySpace.com blogging platform to place in the 21st century the teacher assistance study groups, blackboards and whiteboards, is extremely convenient. You can sit in your dorm rooms at home, whatever, and be viewing the TAs and sort of blogging type issues and stylists with the teacher assistants and many different points of view. Have these commentaries pre-fed in by certain professors on the same the subject of different angles that these study groups could be held in a sort of a blogging website manner by teacher assistants. So perhaps, you know, MIT's research lab could probably lead in this direction.
Nice.
A couple of things. There is actually a journal, International Journal of Open Education Resources, that covers not just the courseware, but also the emerging open source software that runs courses and enables people to publish courses, and emerging standards that allow you to export and trade not just whole courses, but elements of courses. So you can build courses from modules of other people's courses.
Who publishes that?
It's an online e-journal, EduForge.
What is
The journal is International Journal of Open Educational Resources. And the action item here, I think that it seems to be obvious, and you say you're heading towards, is the integration of social networking tools. And the ability to have self-selected communities support each other in the course.
Time to wrap up.
Yeah, I think we're done. We've got one.
We have like a minute left.
We have a minute. We have
another comment there.
Real short. Sam? Okay.
Sure. I mean, it's just sort of, if we're talking about using students to Facebook and we're talking about integrating social networking in, is it worth taking a look at the fact that Facebook now lets third parties write widgets that fit into this framework? So if you're losing students to that audience, it's quite possible to insert tools for them that let them chat within Facebook about a particular course with people also registered for that course.
Right.
Essentially, if that's a huge concern for people, you can build things into reports right into Facebook.
Yeah.
That's new level.
So that will have to be agreed. Because they have 100% penetration that you said it for years.
Thank you all for coming. We've got about 15 minutes and then we reconvene over in the Austin Auditorium or Austin Hall Ames Auditorium where we're at this morning.